Hi, everyone. My name is Larry Adams, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. Good to be here. I'm glad you told that, Jack. I was going to tell on you, but I thought I was nervous till I talked to him. I want to tell you that my sobriety date's November the 7th, 1978. My home group's the Shavelle. Thank you. My home group's the Shavelle group. We meet in Louisville on Sunday night, and my sponsor's Jack S. Any of you know him, you let him know I said Jack S, not Jack Ass. I call him that sometimes when he's not around. But I love him to death. He's been a good sponsor for me, and he's helped me in this program because he showed me by example. He's given me something to live by, and I love him for that. You know, he don't tell me to do nothing. He shows me how this program works, and that's been real important to me. I want to thank Sandy and the committee for inviting me down. When Sandy called me, I told her I'd be glad to come, and she gave me the real clincher. She told me about that possum pie. And I ate some possum pie last night, so I've had a wonderful time. It's been real nice, and I want to thank Jack and Trish for taking us out today. Trish didn't buy much because she almost got run over by a car, running from side to them stores down there. But we've had a good time. This is a beautiful place, you know, and I'd like to tell all the smokers downstairs, light one up for me right now. I feel like I could smoke a pack right now. Now that y'all know I got a coat, I'm going to take it off. I'm hot. I remember being about 3 months sober, and I went to my first conference, and I did not want to go. And my wife's Al-Anon sponsor and her husband roped us into it, and I fought it all the way, and I had to dress up. And I went to my first conference 3 months sober, and a guy got up to talk, and he had on a nice suit and a tie. I was sitting way in the back, and I thought, now what is this slick dude got to tell a guy like me? And his name was Johnny H. Some of y'all heard Johnny. And Barbara made sure I heard every word that Johnny said, because she nudged me all the way through the meeting. You know, we could identify with Johnny, and I'm so grateful that I went to that conference, because he took away my uniqueness. See, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought I was terribly unique. Nobody had done the things that I had done or lived the way I had lived. And I started going to AA meetings, and I'm so grateful to the people that got behind these podiums and shared their experience, strength, and hope with me, because it took away my uniqueness. I remember going to a meeting down in Louisville, and a guy got up, and he talked about talking to vacuum cleaners. And I like that old boy. I mean, he made me laugh, you know. And I went to my second meeting, and a guy got up, and he was a wino, and he talked about drinking wine and crapping in his pants. And I thought, I might be in the right place. You know? I could identify with them people. And I think that's what Alcoholics is all about. It's one alcoholic identifying with another. And that's what I'm going to try and do tonight, is to tell you my experience, strength, and hope. What I used to be like, what happened to me, and what I'm like today. And believe me, my life is so different today. I heard a joke when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to share it with you. It kind of reminds me of me and my wife. I'd like to introduce my wife. We've been together 37 years. Stand up, Barbara. Barbara's one of them old black belt Al-Anons. And in November, I celebrated 18 years, and we had been married 18 years of the drinking and 18 years of sobriety. And I looked at her, and I said, we're even. You don't ever want to tell an Al-Anon that. She said, what about the dry drunks? I'm behind again, you know. There's no way I'm ever going to get caught up. But the joke I heard was about a judge. Now, I've never been a judge, but I've been in front of a lot of them. And I like to tell jokes on them. If there's a judge here, I'll make amends after the meeting. But it seemed like he was an alcoholic, and he wanted to get out and drink, and he told his wife one night he was going down to the courthouse and work on some papers. And he got out of the house, and he went down to his favorite beer joint. He got to drinking, and during the course of the night, he got drunk, and he got sick, and he threw up all over the front of his shirt. And he's going home that night, and he thought, what am I going to tell my wife? So he tiptoed in, took his shirt off, threw it down the clothes hamper. The next morning, he got ready to go to work. She was standing at the door with his briefcase. And he started out, and she said, say, what happened to you last night? I heard that a lot. And he said, well, what do you mean, honey? She said, well, I was downstairs doing the laundry this morning. I put your shirt in the washing machine. It had vomit all over the front of it. Well, being a good alcoholic, you know, we're quick thinkers. And he said, oh, I meant to tell you about that. He said, last night, I was down at that courthouse, and I was working on some papers, and they brought a drunk in. And he said, I was trying to help him with that drunk, and he got sick and threw up all over the front of my shoulder. He said, but don't you worry about it. When he comes in front of that bench this morning, I'm going to give him 30 days. She said, you ought to give him 90 days. He said, how come 90? She said, he done something in your pants, too. That was me and Barbara. I could tell him to her, but she was always one step ahead of me. You know, I want to tell you tonight, there's three kinds of drinkers. There's a social drinker, there's a heavy drinker, and there's an alcoholic. I want to tell you how you tell the difference. If you're sitting in a bar and a social drinker walks in, they'll order a drink. They'll sit down and get a drink, get ready to drink it, and they'll look down and see there's a fly in it. And they'll miss. And they'll holler for the waitress, and she'll come over, and they'll say, there's a fly in my drink. Would you bring me another one? She'll bring them another one. Now, the old heavy drinker will walk in. He'll order a drink, sit down, get ready to drink it, look down and see there's a fly. He'll pick the fly up, set it on the table, drink that drink. Now, the good old alcoholic will come in. He'll order a drink, he'll look down and see there's a fly in it, and he'll grab that fly and holler, spit it out, spit it out. You know? That's the way I was. I didn't want that fly to get none of mine, you know? I was a pig from the word go, you know? I want to tell you that I was born and raised down in Louisville, Kentucky. I'm from an alcoholic family. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and a woman told me, she said, Larry, you was from a dysfunctional family. I said, hell, I was from a dysfunctional neighborhood. You know, everybody in our neighborhood was just like us. It was a Catholic neighborhood, large families. Now, we wasn't Catholics, but my daddy took lessons from us. Because there wound up being 13 of us in our family. There was 9 boys. And it was an exciting place to grow up. I want you to know that we was the Addams family long before they come on television. We provided the weekend entertainment in our neighborhood, you know. There was always something going on at my house with all them boys. And we was like stair steps, you know, growing up, and it was real exciting. And I seen what alcoholism would do, because my dad would stop on Friday nights up to the beer joint, and he would get drunk, and he would come home, and I was just a little small kid. And him and Mom would get to fighting, and my dad would get butcher knives out and run my mother through the house. And I hid under beds and in closets to get away from my father. I loved him and I hated him. I couldn't understand that. You know, he was a good man, but when he got drunk, it was awful. And I remember hiding under them beds and in closets, and I remember thinking, boy, when I get big, I'm going to get my mother, and I'm going to get her away from all of this. And little did I know the same disease that my father had, I was to have also. And little did I know I was going to put my mother through a lot of heartache. Because later on in my life, my mother would stand at a living room window and she would look out and she would wonder where I was because I hadn't been home in 2 or 3 days, and she would hear them sirens and she would stand there and cry. And I never set out to do that. I knew nothing about a disease called alcoholism. But I know today, had I never took a drink of alcohol, I still would have been a menace to society. Because I found out real early in that large family that if you couldn't get attention with good behavior, you can get all you want with bad behavior. And boy, I got my share of it. You know, in grade school, I was the class clown. I entertained my classmates. And I got into high school, and it wasn't no different. And about 12 years old, there was a library down where I lived. It had a great big old hill behind it. And all of us young boys would get up there at nighttime, and we would play football, and we would wrestle. I was 12 years old, and I was up on that library hill, and one of the guys said, Larry, we're all going to pool our money together tonight and get something to drink. Do you want to go with us? I didn't have a craving for alcohol at 12 years old, but I tell you what I wanted. I wanted to be part of that tough guy crowd on the corner. And I would have went anywhere and done anything to be part of them. And I went with them that night at the age of 12, and I got drunk, and I got sick, and I got in trouble with the police. That was to be my story for the next 25 years. I did it over and over and over. I'm in high school, and I'm already drinking. My grades are horrible, and I got old enough to quit school. My daddy had a rule at our house, and it was called 16 and out. And I thought that was awful unfair, but if I'd have had 13, I'd have had that rule too, you know. But we like to drove him crazy, so I had a brother, and he was a jockey. And he's a rich, famous jockey. You know, I know he rode all over here in New Orleans and everywhere, and he made a lot of money. And he would come home for visits when I was growing up, and he would bring jockeys home with him. And he would go up into a section we lived in called Portland. It was a tough place. There was a bar on every corner. And there was some real nice bars down there where the band played behind chicken wire, and the tables was bolted to the floor, and there's a lot of action in them joints. And my brother would take them jockeys there, and he'd throw them $20 bills around like he'd just printed them. And, you know, at 16 years old, I probably weighed 90 pounds. And I thought, that's it, man. I'm going away and become a rich, famous jockey, and I'll never have to want for nothing. And at 16 years old, I left home and went to seek my fame and fortune on the racetrack. And I went to Boston, Massachusetts. Now, if you've never heard about me, don't become too alarmed. The only thing I was going to ride up in Boston was a beach up there called Riviera Beach. And I passed out on that beach night after night after night. Because immediately I found the people to drink. And them was the people I began to run with. And I run the country. And if I had a good time in my alcoholism, it was then. Because I was young, I could shake them hangovers off, and I could go on. And that's what I did. I run the country and drank. Had a brother to come to see me up there, and I thought it was nice he come 1,000 miles to visit me, and I found out he was hiding from the FBI. That's what he was doing up there. They finally found him, brought him back to Louisville, and I got homesick, and I thought, well, I'll go back home. And I remember going into the house, and I thought, boy, I'll bet my dad and mom would be glad to see me. And my dad come in from work that night, and he seen me, and he said, Christ's sake, are you back again? You know, I didn't like him before, and I sure didn't like him then. But my brothers had smartened my dad up, and he said, look, you're not going to lay around in this bed all day and hang on street corners at nighttime. If you're going to stay here, you got a mind. I want to tell you, my whole family's painters. If you heard about drunken painters, that's what I was. And it wasn't long for my behavior. My dad asked me to leave again. And I went to one of my brother's house, and I knocked on his door. And he answered the door, and I said, Ralph, Dad run me off. Can I stay all night? He said, well, yeah, brother, come on in. It took him a year to get rid of me. You know, I was like bubble gum. When I got in, I stuck. I began to hang in beer joints. I had about five brothers, and they're hanging in them beer joints. And, you know, there's a lot of action in them beer joints. And I had a brother, Norman, and he would rather fight than eat. And I kept him in training. You know, I'd start him, and he would finish him. I began to go to jail a lot, you know, for drunk, disorderly conduct. And I never once thought there was anything wrong with that. Everybody I was running with was going to jail on a regular basis. And I thought, well, you know, that's the price you pay to do what you want to do. And I was willing to pay that price for a long time. But I'm standing up on that corner one day, and me and my wife was raised in the same neighborhood. I've known her since she was 5 years old. You know, I don't ever remember meeting her. She was part of the neighborhood. And I hadn't seen her for a while. You know, I'd come back from the racetrack, and I've been drinking, and I'm standing up on that corner, and she come around that corner, and man, she had grew up, and she had filled out, and she had what I wanted, and I was willing to go to any lengths to get it, you know. And we began to date. Now, we had to date in secret. I don't know if any of y'all had her dated in secret, but her daddy hated my gut. And he used to tell her, stay away from that Adams boy. Now, Barbara was a good Christian girl. She went to a school that taught religion. She studied the Bible, you know, made good grades. She didn't drink. She didn't smoke. She didn't cuss. She didn't play race horses. She didn't do nothing exciting. And I thought it was my duty to change all of that, you know. But we would slip around, and I could not understand why her daddy didn't like me. I thought he was picking on me. And, you know, I look back today, and her poor old daddy would be out in the yard cutting grass. And I'd come home after being out all night, Saturday around noon or something, and I'd be staggering down the street, and I'd throw a bottle at him, a whiskey bottle, empty, of course, and call him an SB and couldn't understand why he didn't want his daughter to go out with me. You know, I thought he was picking on me. But we got married, and we was going to live happily ever after. We didn't know nothing about alcoholism, and we got married, and man, we started having kids. I thought we was going to have 13 like my daddy till we found out what was causing it. We had a girl, and then we had a boy, and it wasn't long until Barbara was pregnant with our third child. And my drinking has really escalated. I'm getting in all kinds of trouble. I'm always in court. I'm running with the wildest crowd I can find in Louisville, and we're riding the streets of Louisville on Friday and Saturday night. If you left something out in your yard and we wanted it, we took it. because I thought the world was a mark. And I want to tell you that when you live like that, sooner or later, you have to pay for it. And it wasn't long till I was standing in front of one of them judges I told you about, and he sentenced me to 10 years in the Kentucky State Penitentiary. And Barbara was pregnant with our third child, and she began to cry in the courtroom. And my mother and daddy was there, and they began to cry. And I looked back, and I thought, what the hell are you all crying for? I'm going to the penitentiary. You know, I tell you that because at 23 years old, I had lost the ability to care about another human being. The only person I cared about was myself. Selfishness and self-centered is the root of all of our problems. Boy, could I identify with that. But away I went to the penitentiary, and guess what? All my friends was there, you know. They said, hey, Larry, what took you so long? And I thought, I wonder how they knew I was coming. I got in the penitentiary, and there's not a lot of social life in the penitentiary, you know, when you don't have nothing to do. They had a great big old loop. It went all the way around the penitentiary. We called it walking the loop. And I'm in there, and I'm walking the loop one day, and a buddy of mine come up, and he said, Larry, you want to go to a meeting? I said, what kind of meeting? He said, an AA meeting. I said, are you crazy? I said, what in the world would I want to go to an AA meeting for in the penitentiary? He said, well, might look good to the parole board. I said, where's the meeting at? I don't care why you go, you know. And I want you to know, for about the next 18 months, I attended AA meetings once a week, whether I needed them or not. And I would go to a meeting, and they would bring a speaker in on Wednesday night, and he would get up and share his story like I'm trying to tonight. And you know, the meeting would get over with, and I'd start back to my dormitory, and I'd look at one of my buddies, and I'd say, damn, that guy's had a rough life, ain't he? You know? Now, he went out the front gate, went home to his wife and children. I went back and got locked up. My sponsor, Jack, told me the word insanity ought to come real easy for me. You know? I could not connect that I was in the penitentiary as a direct result of alcoholism. Barbara went on aid for dependent children. And she kept that family together. And she had our third baby shortly after I went in that penitentiary. And I held that kid for the first time behind bars. And I used to tell her she would ride a bus up to see me. And I said, boy, when I get out of here, things are going to be different. You just wait for me, baby. And when I get out of here, we're going to live different. And I made parole, and I went home to Barbara and them three kids, and we lived happily ever after for 2 weeks. You know, we went on one of them little honeymoons you got to go on when you've been gone. You got to get caught up, and it don't take long to get caught up. And I got bored. And I said, I'm going to walk up to the corner and see some of my buddies. And I did. I walked up to the corner, and my buddies was all there, and he said, hey, Larry, we're glad you're back. Have a beer. And it's right where I left off. They talk about the progression even when you don't drink. I was right back to the same spot. We tried the geographical cure this time in our life. Barbara used to tell me it was the people that I run with. So we bought a house. She went some money at the racetrack, and we bought a house and moved out into Shively where we live today. And we got out into Shively, and I remember shortly after we got out there, Barbara said, I know what's wrong with you, Larry. She always knew what was wrong with me. And I said, what's that? She said, nobody's ever taught you how to drink. And she said, I'm going to take you out tonight, and I'm going to learn you how to social drink. And I thought, well, she's buying, I'm going, you know. And I remember she got me in a car, and she took me out there's a place on Bardstown Road called the Toy Tiger. You can imagine with a name like that. And we walked in there, and the band was playing. I got snapping my fingers, and I thought, boy, we're going to have a good time in here tonight. And she ordered me a vodka and orange juice. And I went to grab it up and chug a lug it down, and she reached over and said, no, 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 no. She said, you don't drink like that. She said, you sit here, and you listen to the music, and you sip on that. And she said something I'll never forget. She said, two of them ought to do you while we're here. I thought, boy, we ain't going to be here long. You know. And I remember sitting in that Toy Tiger, sipping on that vodka and orange juice, and I looked across the table at her, and I thought, damn you, I hate you. You don't want me to have no fun. And I stood it as long as I could, and I said, man, if this is social drinking, you can have it. And I snapped my fingers for that waitress, and she began to bring them drinks like I liked them. And when we left that night, Barbara helped me out to the car, and she drove home, and she never took me back, so I guess I flunked social drinking. You know, a lot of people's trying to help me. I had got a good maintenance paint job by now. I was working for a rubber company down in Louisville and making pretty good money, and my drinking was just going crazy. And in 1974, I fell. and I had to be rushed to the hospital, and I had to have one of many back surgeries I've had. And from 1974 to 1978, alcohol and drugs completely took my life over. I don't talk about drugs and Alcoholics Anonymous for two reasons. One's the singleness of purpose, and the other one is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous takes care of every addiction I have. I don't need to go to 10 dozen special meetings. Thank you. But my life become a nightmare in 74, and, our life become a nightmare. My children slowly just kind of drifted away from me. My son was a football player in high school, and he would beg me to come to football games, and I'd tell him I would. And I'd go to football games to see my son, and while he was down on the field playing football, his drunken father was up in the stands creating chaos, fighting and carrying on and getting locked up. My daughters were cheerleaders, and my son won a lot of trophies in school, and he would beg me to come to award banquets, and I'd promise him I would. And I want to tell you tonight that I never seen my son get one trophy. The closest I ever got was when my son was getting a trophy. His drunken father was laying out in the parking lot, passed out in a pool of puke. But I'd have told you, leave me alone. I'm not hurting anybody but myself. And the damage that I did to my children has took a long time in this program to heal. And I'm not proud of them things. I know it took what it took for me to get here. But the damage I done on the people that I love still hurts. But we kept going that way, and things got bad. And in 1977, I had, when you're doing alcohol and drugs, it takes a lot of money. And this job I had wasn't making enough money, so I'd have to work extra. And I'm going to tell you about one of my jobs, and then I'm going to talk about sobriety. My brother Norman called me up, and he said, we need some painters this weekend out to Ford Motor Company. Would you like to go? And I said, Lord, yes, I need the money. He said, well, we'll pick you up at 5:30 in the morning. Be ready. And at 5:30 in the morning, they honked the horn. I went out and climbed in the car, and they had a bag of reefers and a big old cooler full of vodka and orange juice, and they was already wasted at 5:30. And I climbed in that car, and I thought, this is going to be a good job. You know, I knew we was going to have fun that day. And we went out to the Ford Motor Company. It wasn't long till the vodka and orange juice was gone. I said, I'm going home. And my nephew said, what's the matter, Uncle Aaron? I said, man, we ain't got nothing to drink. I can't stay here. He said, well, you can't get out of here. And I said, oh, you can get out anywhere. And I looked around. They rode on little golf carts out there. And there's a golf cart sitting there. And I went over and hit the starter button, and it started. And whistled for my nephew. And we drove up to the gatehouse and parked it and told the guard that we had to go after some paint. And he let us out. And, we went after paint, all right, at a liquor store. We got a bottle of whiskey for every pocket we had. And we come on back and started through the gatehouse, and he seen a bottle of whiskey dangling out my nephew's pocket, and he grabbed it. And we got kind of belligerent with it. And he said, well, I'm going to call the captain and see what he wants to do with y'all. And when he went to use the phone, we snatched up that bottle of whiskey he grabbed, and we run out and jumped on that golf cart. And away we went. And my nephew said, Uncle Larry, they're coming after us. And I looked back, and there was two guards, and they was on a golf cart. And they was chasing us. And he said, you better open this thing up. And I said, man, I got it as fast as it'll go. And he said, we better do something or we're going to get caught. And we rounded this corner. And when we went around this corner, I spotted the shiniest fire engine I ever seen in my life. Now, I've never drove one before, and I haven't drove one since. But I was drunk enough to drive that one that day. And we pulled over to that fire engine, and me and him jumped on it. It had a set of keys dangling on it. Now, I don't know about y'all, but you can't drive a fire engine until you get the siren and the light working. And we got the siren and the light working, and away we went on that fire truck. And I remember my nephew looking back at them guards waving at us. Now, I told y'all when I was growing up, I liked a lot of attention. And I looked at my nephew, and I said, you know what? I had five brothers working on that job. And I said, he'd be ashamed to steal his fire truck and not let my brothers see. I knew they wanted to see that fire truck. And so I told him to hang on, and we went down through an aisle, and the Ford Motor Company was just big enough to get this fire truck through. And there was people working in there that day, and we had that lighter going and that siren going. And people was diving out of the way, and my nephew was hollering, run over them, Uncle Larry, kill them, SB. We took that fire truck to where my brothers was, and they was real impressed. Their eyes got big, and their mouth fell open. And every guard at the Ford Motor Company was impressed, too, because they all showed up there. And they was ticked off because we sold that fire engine, and we got to arguing with them. And one of these guards shoved me. Well, I told you all my brother Norman done all my fighting. And when this guard shoved me, my brother hit him upside the head. And we had one of the biggest free-for-alls out there you ever seen. Now, I used to tell this story in my favorite beer joint before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and went something like this, that we whipped every guard at the Ford Motor Company. But after I come to you people, you taught me about a word I hated. It was called honesty. I'll tell you tonight what really happened out there at the Ford Motor Company. We got the shit beat out of it. I was the littlest and I got the worst. They mopped the floor up with me. I had a hinky on the side of my head as big as a watermelon. And you know, they didn't lock us up. They threw us out of the Ford Motor Company, me and my brother and Norman and my nephew, and we stood outside and we said, we'll be back. We're going home and get our pistols and we'll come back and show you how bad we are. But we got detained along the way. We run into another beer joint. Now, I'd been out since 5:30 that morning, told you what kind of day I had. I hadn't had enough. I went home and got a car later and took off trying to catch my nephew and was doing 90 miles an hour and I blacked out at the wheel. And I hit five trees and I flipped that car five times. And my son, who had grew up in my alcoholism, hiding under beds and in closets the same way my dad did me, he was the first person to arrive at the scene of that wreck. And he was sure his daddy was dead. But he knew enough not to leave me there, and he took me home. And I don't remember that wreck, but I remember coming to the next morning. I was in my bed. And, man, I had broken ribs. I'd been in that fight. I was all beat up. I probably weighed 115 pounds. And this sweet, wonderful, religious girl that I had married had turned into an attack dog. I woke up that morning, and she was sitting on my chest. And she had that finger going, and she began to tell me all this crazy stuff that had went on the night before. And she said, I don't know how you're alive. You wrecked that car. And I said, oh, if I had a wreck like that, I'd be dead. And she got me in another car, and she took me to the junkyard, and I looked at that car, and I looked at her, and I said, that's it. I'll never drink again. Well, any of y'all ever quit for never? That's a long time. I got drunk that night, you know. I meant that. But I went into work the following Monday morning. Like I told you, physically I was beat up. And I went over to the paint shop, and everybody that drank and drug was hanging over there. And the phone rang this morning. It was the personnel director at my job. And he said, Larry, I want to see you over at the office. And all them guys said, what's Bill want with you? I said, well, as good of an employee as I am, he probably wants to give me a raise, you know. So I went over to his office, and I remember walking in. He was looking out a window. And he turned around and looked at me, and his mouth dropped open, and his eyes got big, and he said, my God, Larry, you look awful. I thought, hell, you just had the kind of week I had. You wouldn't look too good either. But he looked at me that morning. That was in 1977. And he said, Larry, I know what's wrong with you. And I said, what's that, Bill? And he said, you're an alcoholic. And I know a place that could help you. And I got fighting mad. I stomped out of his office, and I went back over to the paint shop with all my buddies. They said, what Bill want with you? And I said, y'all will never believe what he called me. They said, what's that, Larry? And I said, he said, I'm an alcoholic. They said, oh, man, he tells everybody that. Come on and have a beer. Y'all know who I believe. You know, I continued to drink for another year. A year after I left his office, I'd been out on about a four-day drunk, and as a result of that, I overdosed on alcohol and drugs. And I wound up in University Hospital in Louisville, Kentucky, strapped down on a gurney, and I had a tube in every hole I had. And I was sick as a dog. And I'm laying there on that gurney, and a woman walked up to me, and I found out she was a psychiatrist. And she said, Larry, we're going to put you upstairs before you hurt yourself or somebody. And I remember thinking, she's going to lock me up. So I began to con and manipulate like I had done all my life. And I looked up at that woman, and I said, look, if you'll let me out of this hospital, I'm going to do something about my drinking. And she said, do you really mean it, Larry? And I'm laying on a gurney, and I got straps on my legs and my waist and my arms, but I could get my swearing hand up. And I looked up at her and I said, I swear to God, if you'll let me out of here, I'm going to do something about my drinking. And you know, she bought my story. And she let me out of that hospital, and I did do something about my drinking. I stopped at the first beer joint I could find, and I got a six-pack. Because I'm going to tell you, friends, by now, I had to drink to live. And I want to tell you tonight that if you haven't done the things that I have done, if you haven't wrecked cars and stolen fire engines and been to the penitentiary, they're not a requirement for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, thank God. You know, I asked my sponsor once, and he said some of us are sicker than others. And that's probably true. Because I'm going to tell you what, the things that happened to me, that wasn't what drove me to my knees. What finally beat me is what I believe beats every man and woman that walks into their first AA meeting, or every Al-Anon that walks into the first meeting. And it's called feelings. It's knowing that every day is going to be just like the day before. It's helplessness and hopelessness and despair. It's wanting to die and being scared to die. You know, it's waking up in the morning and putting your feet over on the side of the bed and putting your head in your hands and crying. Because you knew you had to rob and steal and lie to the very people that you loved the most. And that's where I was on November the 7th, 1978. And I got up and went into work that morning, and I had to pass that personnel director's office. And he wasn't in his office. And I started over to the paint shop, and I went around to the side steps where he come in. It was real dark. And I sat on them steps, and I hope that I never forget how I felt that morning. I began to cry. And I knew that if I got off them steps and went to that paint shop, I'd never get back. And he finally come in, and I said, "Bill, you told me about a place that can help a guy like me." I said, "Where is it?" And he told me about a treatment center. And I had my famous last words. I said, "I'll go tomorrow." And he said, "No, you're going right now." And he called my wife, and him and my wife took me to a treatment center on November the 7th, 1978. And I had no idea that I was about to begin a journey into Alcoholics Anonymous. I stayed 30 days in that treatment center, and they got me physically well, and they thoroughly introduced me to a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I left that treatment center after 30 days, and I went home to Barbara and three teenage children. And I thought we was going to be the Beaver family. It was awful, man. I set my three children down at the kitchen table, and I said, "Things are going to be different." And my youngest daughter went, "Oh, no." And I went to a meeting that night, and my first sponsor, his name was Dave, and I said, "Dave, my family don't believe me." He said, "Hell, I don't believe you either." He said, "All we got to go on is your track record." He said, "Larry, I'm going to tell you something. I hope you never forget it." He said, "The greatest talk you'll ever make is the one you walk." He said, "You need to walk in front of the people that you love and that love you and let them see the changes." Now, I'd like to tell you we was instantly a happy family, but it was awful at my house. I held court at the kitchen table, you know, while they was trying to eat their dinner, and they wouldn't hear real good, and I'd have to bang on the table and use a lot of profanity, which was my favorite vocabulary at that time. And then they wouldn't listen, I'd have to throw little temper fits. Any of y'all ever threw temper fits? I used to jump up and down and beat on the table and the countertop. And a guy in AA told me, he said, "Larry, you know what's wrong with you?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "You got a little brat inside of you. And his name's Buster." And he said, "Buster's running your life." He said, "You need to spank his ass and put him to bed." Well, I'm going to tell you, I still have to spank Buster today because he'll run my life, you know. But it was awful. My wife, she had begun to go to Al-Anon, and I used to carry my sobriety like a club over her head. You know, she didn't do just what I wanted her to. I said, "I'll get drunk." And boy, she would shape up right now. But them women in Al-Anon got a hold of her, and my life was about to change, you know. I hated her Al-Anon sponsor. And the only thing I hated worse than her Al-Anon sponsor was her Al-Anon sponsor's husband. He was in AA. And man, he was a mean old guy. And one night, Barbara wasn't doing something, and I looked at her and I said, "I'll get drunk." And she turned around and looked me dead in the face, and she said, "Who gives a shit?" Yeah. She's starting to hear something. She said, "Your sobriety is your responsibility. I'll not take no credit for it, and I'll not take no blame for it." And I thought, man, I got to get her away from that woman, you know. Thank God for that couple, because they began to invite us places, and I didn't want to go. And I'd tell Barbara their name was Nancy and Louie. And I'd say, "If Louie calls and wants us to go somewhere, you tell him we ain't going." And old Louie would call. Now, Louie could cuss like a sailor, and he knew how to get my attention. And old Louie would call, and Barbara would hand me the phone. And I'd say, "What time you going to pick us up?" I was scared of Louie, you know. They began to take us places. By now, all of our children had left. My son began to fall in the back door drunk, and loaded on grass, and I thought, how can he do this to me? As good of a daddy as I've been to this kid. And I had enough ego at that time, I thought, well, I'll straighten him out with all my vast experience. If there's anybody in here tonight trying to straighten out your children, lots of luck. You know, it got awful. My son joined the Navy to get away from me. My two daughters moved to Texas. Moved in with my sister. That left me and Barbara. Now, you talking about two sorry people. We used to sit at the table and just stare at each other. We didn't know how to communicate. Hell, all we ever talked about was what I'd done the night before. Now we're going to AA and Al-Anon, and thank God he'd give us our first link together. We would come home and talk about maybe something we heard at a meeting or somebody we met. And, you know, it was a start for us. And couples began to get a hold of us, and they began to take us places. And I remember there was 50 couples got together shortly after I was sober, and they took us to see a play called Camelot. I had never seen a play in my life. I mean, they didn't have plays where I hung out, you know? And it was awesome. I enjoyed it. And I remember they had a halftime intermission, whatever you call a play, and I went out to smoke a cigarette, and one of them old tough boys from that end of town that I was grew up in, he said, Larry, I didn't know you liked this kind of stuff. I said, hell, I didn't either, you know? But we began to go to meetings. I went to a meeting every night, and thank God for the people that was here when I got here. There was a lot of guys that stood out in parking lots after meetings, sometimes till 11 and 12 o'clock at night, and let me get all this craziness out of my head. They took the time to stand in them parking lots, and I'll be eternally grateful to them guys. And we kept going to meetings, and got me a home group, got me a sponsor. My first sponsor was a nice guy. He finally left Alcoholics Anonymous. They said he left to get away from me. But he really went back to church. He went back and joined his church, and he quit coming. But he used to work in a computer room at nighttime. And he was on a late shift. And I could call him about 10:30 at night. I had crises. I don't know about y'all, but you have crises at 10:30 at night. And I'd call him up at 10:30 at night and tell him about all this stuff that was going on with me. And he listened for a while. And one night I called him, he said, Larry, why don't you do what normal people do? I said, what do normal people do? He said, at 10:30 at night, they go to bed, and he hung up on me. He was teaching me to keep this program simple, you know. And I tell that to a lot of people I sponsor today, and I still apply that to my life. Sometimes when I'm having a bad day, I just need to go to bed, you know. Tomorrow's always better. And we had, you know, I had some fun times. Now, I won't tell all you newcomers that these old-timers will nickname you when you come here. They won't tell you, but they'll nickname. I come here, I probably weigh maybe 115 pounds, and I had an old trench coat I used to wear. And I'd go into the meetings, and I'd get back against the wall. And they nicknamed me Columbo. They'd say, here comes Columbo, you know. I'd have killed him if I'd have hurt him. But I kept going to meetings. Somehow, a day at a time, I stayed sober in this program, and I had my first year anniversary. I'd been sober 1 year. And I was proud. And I got my token. And shortly after I got my token, I went to my sponsor, and I said, Dave, there's something wrong with me. He said, there's a whole lot wrong with you. He said, what's the matter, Larry? And I want to tell you, that first year, I didn't pick that book up. I didn't work a step. All I did was go to meetings. And, you know, I was as dry as you can be. And I want to tell you tonight that if you're sitting here and you're dry, you stay here. Because you've got to be dry to get sober. And that's exactly what happened to me. I said, I see people around AA that's got something I've never touched. And he said, you want more out of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, yeah. And he said, you got to do more. And I said, like what? And he said, like the 12 steps. And you got to begin to read the book. And with his steps, with his guidance, I began to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and with his help I began to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. He helped me through them first three steps, and we got to step four, and he said, you got to do an inventory. I said, I've already done an inventory in treatment. He said, well, you've done an inventory all right, but it's been everybody around AA's and your wife and kids. He said, you need to do one on yourself. And with his help, I sat down, and for the first time in my life, I looked at this emotional, immature, spoiled little brat that had never grew up and had blamed everybody else for his misery. And that's exactly what I was. You know, I had to sit down with that pencil and look at the part that I had played and the destruction that I had caused to a lot of people in my life. I got it all wrote, and I said, what do I do with it now? And he said, you got to read it to somebody. I heard a guy say he read his to a priest that was hard of hearing, and right after he read it, he went and got a hearing aid, you know. But I read it with my sponsor, and I remember we sat in a park, and for the first time in my life, I took my false face off, and I let another human being know all about me. And I want to tell you what, I passed through an archway to freedom with that fifth step. And I think that's an important step. I think each step's important. But that fifth step is my humility step. Because you let me think I'm a big shot in this program, you let that gal or that gal that you done your fifth step with walk in that room, you get real humble. At least I do, you know, because they know everything about me. And he helped me through the steps, and my life began to change. Our children was gone. Me and Barbara was going to AA and Al-Anon, and we was doing real good together. And I'd change sponsors, and I got Jack, and I used to say, man, I wish my kids would come back home. I'd like to be a dad again. And he said, be careful what you pray for. And my children began to come home one at a time. I'm going to tell you what, if God had sent them all back at the same time, we'd have killed each other. But he sent my youngest daughter back first. Her name's Sherry. Sherry's a sweet little girl. She's a Christian girl, and she's married a nice guy. And when she come home, me and Sherry just kind of got back together. You know, she's seen a change in her dad and her mom because we was going to AA and Al-Anon. And we began to have some good times, and we began to talk, and she come to some conferences and to some meetings. And she was living with us then, and she got a job in a bank. And she come home all excited one day, and she said, Dad, I got some tickets to the ballet. And I thought, whoopee, you know. And she said, will you and Mom go with me? She said, well, I got some seats right down front. And, you know, we wanted to be with our daughter, and we told her we would go. And we went to a Center for the Arts down in Louisville, Kentucky, a big, beautiful building. I had on a nice suit and tie, and Barbara was all dressed up. And we got about the third row in center stage. And we got ready to start, and this woman walked out on the stage. And she made a mistake like that gentleman from the Chamber of Commerce did. She walked out and she said, hi, my name's Kathy. And I hollered, hi, Kathy. Now, I was the only one in the auditorium that hollered, hi, Kathy. My daughter about died. She said, Dad, you can't take you nowhere. Alcoholics Anonymous has want you. And we laughed about that. My oldest daughter moved to Texas. Got married down there, had two grandkids. I used to say, man, I wish they'd move closer to Louisville so I could see them grandkids. And my sponsors say, what'd you pray for? Well, they not only moved closer to Louisville, she left her husband and they moved in our house. A four-year-old and a six-year-old. And I had the time of my life. I used to tell Jack, I said, man, I get along good with that four-year-old. He said, you are too, you're all the same age. You know? I was retired by now. I had went on disability, and I'd had quite a few back surgeries. And Barbara, my wife, was working part-time then, and my daughter come home and got a job. And guess who babysat it? Them two grandkids. Grandpa. I used to take a six-year-old to school, and I'd spend the day or half a day till Barbara come home with a four-year-old. And I want to tell you how our day went. We'd go to the video store, and we'd get a little video. We'd stop, you know, and get that video, and we'd come home. I got a great big old king-size bed in my bedroom, bunch of pillows, and we'd pop that video in, and I'd make that little fellow a snack, and we'd get up on that bed, and he'd get right here in the crook of my arm. And every once in a while, he'd reach over, and he'd kiss me on the cheek. He'd say, I love you, Papa. You can have my drink tonight. That little fella and his brother has never seen their grandfather take a drink. They've never seen their grandfather run their grandmother out of the house. And I'm grateful for that. I owe that to the God of my understanding and you people in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. If he can change a guy like me, he can change anybody. My daughter and her husband got back together. Everybody said, you're going to miss them. I said, just till they get out of the driveway. And we go down there. We're getting ready to go down there shortly and spend some time with them. And they come up here. She finally did get a divorce and married a wonderful guy. And he had two kids. So we got four grandbabies down in Texas. And I love them to death. My son, David, He's been a carbon copy of his daddy. He's done everything his father's done. He's been in and out of jails. He's been in prison. He's been in and out of this fellowship. He's had a hard time. And I tried to help David, and I couldn't. I had to turn David over to God. And David lived a rough life. He lived out on the streets. We had to finally ask David not to come in our house anymore because he was stealing stuff. And we just, it was a hard time. And it was real hard watching my son live out on the streets. And we cried many a tear over our son. And we said many a prayer to the God we know today for our son. And about a year ago, I was invited to go down to Louisiana to talk. And I was sick, and I didn't want to go. I was having a lot of back trouble and getting ready to have some surgeries. I told Barbara, I said, I'm going to call in cancer. And she said, why don't we go? It might be good for us. And we got on a plane, and we went down to, I think it was Lafayette or Shreveport, Louisiana. And we went to a conference down there, and I talked down there. And after we got done, one of my daughters was there, and she said, Dad, there's a guy over there that wants to talk to you. And I said, I don't feel like talking to him. I said, I'm sick, and I want to go to the room. And she said, Dad, he's such a nice guy. Please talk to him. And I went over and talked to this guy. His name was Julius. And me and him become the dearest of friends. They would come to Louisville and visit us, and we would go down there and visit them. And they knew all about our children. And one day I was sitting at home, and David come by. He come by to hustle me for a 5 or a 10, you know, or a 20, whatever he could get. He was there, and I was talking to Julius on the phone. He said, is David there? And I said, yeah. And he said, let me talk to David. And I handed the phone to my son. This guy had never met my son. Him and his wife was in Alcoholics Anonymous down in Louisiana. And he invited my son to come down and live with him and his wife. He'd never met my son. I went somewhere that I didn't even want to go and talked to a guy that I didn't even want to talk to. That was God at work in my life. My son, he put me back on the phone. He said, will you buy David a plane ticket? I said, one way. Yeah. And my son went down to Louisiana, and he got sober down there. I don't know what they did to him down there, but maybe it was his time. And David got sober, and about 7 months ago, or however long it's been, my son called me up down there, and he said, Dad, I want to come home. And he's been home, and he was living with me and Barbara for a while, and he's doing great in his fellowship. He's got about 9 months of sobriety today, and we have a wonderful time. He goes to conference with me. We was just down in Oklahoma City, and me and him shared the room down there. Barbara didn't go, and we laid in that room, and we laughed till about 2 o'clock in the morning, like two teenagers. You people have given me back my son, and I'm grateful. And if God removes me from the face of this earth this very night, I don't have to worry about my son, because he's met you people, and his life will never be the same. I know this with all my heart. I've been fortunate since I've been sober. I've seen some of my brothers come into this fellowship. I don't know what time I started, but I'm not done yet. My brother Norman, that guy that used to do my fighting, he was my hero. He used to do my battles and everything. And I was working with him after I got sober, and I got a token from my Alcoholics Anonymous, my home group, and I used to wear it around my neck, and he would smoke marijuana, and he would blow it in my face. And I'd take that token, and I'd shake it at him. And I said, Norman, I got something better than that grass. And he said, man, AA has worked you. See, he lost his drinking buddy. And I was sober a little over a year, and he called me up, and he said, how about taking me up that hospital? I said, what for? He said, hell, if they can help you, they can help me. And my brother Norman become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And him and his wife and me and Barbara went everywhere together. We had a ball in this program. We went everywhere. And we just loved it, man. And my brother was a big, tough guy when he got here. He wouldn't even let you women hug him, much less a man. He wouldn't hold hands at a meeting. I mean, he didn't let nobody get tough, get close to him. He was a big, tough guy. But I'm going to tell you what, stayed around this fellowship, and he began to change. Because the most powerful force in the world is right here in these rooms. It's called L-O-V-E, love. And my brother felt that love, and he began to change, and he began to let people get close to him. My brother was 3 years sober in this program. He called me up one day and he said, "Man, I got some bad news today." I said, "What's the matter, brother?" And he said, "I found out I got cancer." I said, "How bad?" And he said, "I don't know, but I want you to go back to the hospital, to the doctor with me." And we went back to the doctor's office, and my brother was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and he only had 3 months to live. And we walked out of that doctor's office, and he said, "Will you be there for me at the end?" Man, I hadn't been nowhere for anybody. I'd been a taker, not a giver. But I told my brother, I said, "With God's help and the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, we'll get through it one day at a time. And I want you to know that my brother lived exactly 3 months. And most of that 3 months, he lived in a hospital. And at nighttime, I would go up and I would sit with my brother at night. And after everybody would leave, I'd pull a chair up by my brother's bed. And I said, "What do you want to do tonight, Norm?" He'd say, "Why don't you read to me from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous?" And we talked about God. And we talked about love. And we talked about death. And some nights I would look at my brother and he would be laying in that bed suffering. And I thought, "Man, I can't stand this." And some AA or some Al-Anon would slip up through the emergency room to check on these two big tough guys in Portland. That's love. My brother died and I had a hole in me as big as the state of Texas. And I thought, "I can't go on." And I've been taught in this program to get my knees and ask God for the strength to get through the pain when I am going through pain. And I want to tell you what God did for me. He brought me some of the nuttiest people to sponsor. They was just like my brother. You know, my life got busy. I mean, I began to sponsor guys and you know, it was just like my brother, big tough guys. And I remember about 3 months went by and my wife said, "I haven't heard you complain about nothing." I said, "Hell, I ain't got time, you know." And I've learned through this fellowship that when things are going rough, you need to focus on a newcomer. And it'll take away all the pain you're going through. It always works for me. And God has richly blessed me that I've been fortunate enough to sponsor a lot of guys in this program and to guide them through the steps and get them to go into meetings, you know. I learned one thing from my sponsor, and it's called shut up and get in the car. You know, and that's what I tell my pigeons, shut up and get in the car. You know, and I have a ball in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want you to know that I was about 2 months sober, 2 years sober in this program, and me and my dad wasn't on very good terms. I didn't hardly talk to my dad, you know, and my dad got real sick. And my sponsor called me up and said, "You want to go to a meeting tonight?" I said, "Nah, I can't. I got to go to the hospital and see my old man." That's what I called him, my old man. He said, "What's the matter? Don't you want to go?" And I said, "Not particularly." He said, "Why not?" And I said, "Man, my old man never done nothing to make my life miserable." He said, "Larry, how can you want your children to forgive you and you can't forgive your daddy?" He said, "How in the world can you say the Lord's Prayer at the end of an AA meeting and ask God to forgive you your trespasses and you can't forgive your daddy?" He said, "You don't hate your daddy. You hated the things your daddy done. But your daddy done them things because of a disease called alcoholism, the same disease you have." And he said, "You need to go to the hospital and make peace with your daddy." Well, he gave me a lot to think about. And I went up to the hospital. I was 40 years old. And my dad was in his 80s. And I walked into the hospital room and I seen my dad laying in that bed. I knew I didn't hate my dad. Yeah, I hated the things he done. But I know now why he done them things. And I sat down on my dad's bed and I took his hand and I said, "Dad, I just want to tell you that I love you." And I seen a tear come out on my father's cheek. And he said, "I love you too, son." Friends, that's alcoholism. It divides fathers and sons and mothers and daughters and brothers and sisters. And me and my dad made our peace with each other. And my dad got well in that hospital and he lived to be 93 years old. And I had a wonderful time with my father. I never went to see my dad, but I didn't rub his white hair and kiss him on the cheek and tell him I loved him. And I was with my dad the day he died, and I was holding his hand. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous and the merciful God. My mom today, she's 92 years old. I'm from good stock. My mom lived by herself in an apartment for about the past 10 years. We've been real blessed. She was able to take care of herself, and me and my brothers would take care of her. And about 3 months ago, she just got too bad to live by herself. And you remember I told you when I was a little kid, I said, when I get big, I'm going to take care of my mother. God must have felt like I got big enough, because my mother moved in with me and Barbara 3 months ago. And God has given me the opportunity to take care of my mother. You know, make amends. And that's what I've been able to do. And my mother's a handful. She's a handful. She keeps me and Barbara hopping. And, you know, I talked it over with my wife, and she agreed with it. And, you know, I'm real grateful for that. Me and Barbara try and talk things over today. And we try and come to some kind of understanding. I don't know how long my mother will be with me, but she's got to see me sober for 18 years in this fellowship. And I'm so grateful for that. I am blessed beyond my wildest expectations. You know, all I was looking for when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous was a way to live in this world without taking a drink. And God has given me that on a daily basis, one day at a time. You know what gets me in trouble? My lack of faith or my want. You know, I want this and I want that and I don't trust God. And I heard a guy say, when you're having a tough day, tie a knot in a rope and hang on. I'm going to tell you what, let go of the rope. Trust God and work the steps in your life. If it can work for me, it can work for anybody. You know, God has richly blessed me. I'm retired and I've had some bad back surgery. And a couple of years ago, I had to have a 10-hour back surgery. And I had to have, he told me I had to get 5 units of my own blood. And I said, man, I ain't got 5 units of blood in me. And I was right. I only had 2. And I had to have 3 units of blood donated. And I want you to know that one of the guys that I sponsor and 2 guys that I run around with went and gave me blood. And I tease them today. One of them's named Craig, and Craig's kind of lazy. So when Barbara wants me to do something and I don't want to, I tell her it's Craig's blood kicking up. Another one's name is Bobby, and Bobby's fairly new to the program, and he's kind of crazy. And when I'm having a real nutty day, I tell her it must be Bobby's blood. Now, the other one's name's Todd, and he's a young guy, and he chases the girls. And when Barbara catches me looking at one of you two pretty women too long, I tell her it's Todd's blood, you know. I had to be laid up in a hospital bed for 2 months. I wasn't allowed to get up to even go to the bathroom. I had all my DSQs together, and I had rods put in. They wouldn't let me out of bed. And I want you to know that AA members come to my house and brought meetings, and they babysat me while Barbara went to Al-Anon meetings. And I want to tell you the most miraculous thing in the world. They emptied my urinal. Now, if you don't think that ain't great, you call your favorite beer joint and tell your buddy that you're laid up in bed to come over and empty your urinal. And if they'll empty your urinal, you hang on to it and I'll drink it. The people in Alcoholics Anonymous done that for me because they love me. About a year ago, I had to have some more surgery, and I had to have 2 units of blood. And my sponsor, Jack, said, I'm going to give you a unit of blood. And I said, oh, Jack, you're getting too old to get blood. He said, I want you to finally have some royal blood in your family. Now, Jack is an old wino that slept in a cardboard box behind a cafe, and he thinks his blood's royal. That can only happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'm proud to tell you today that I have my sponsor's blood going through my veins, and I love him. And I hope that I can be 1/10 of the AA members that my sponsor is, because he's a very loving, giving man. And I hope that I can follow along in his footsteps and be to this program what he's been to us. Me and Barbara's got a good life today. We're blessed that we can come places like this, and we've met people all over the world. And you know, we've been through our share of trouble. Like I said, I had a lot of back operations. We've had a lot of financial problems when I first retired. And I remember one day we was going through a rather tough time financially, and Barbara said, what are you going to do? And I said, pray. And she was laying on the couch, and I was laying on the living room floor. And about 10 minutes passed. And she said, are you through? And I said, yeah. And she said, what did God say to you? And I said, he said, oh, you have little faith. God picked me up out of the gutter. And he brought me to you people. And I've had 18 years of the most fantastic life that a guy like me could ever hope for. And then sometimes I doubt him. And I try and grow spiritually in this program with the 12 steps. Because I know the more I grow spiritually, the better I feel, and the better human being I am. And I'm grateful to get the opportunity to come to this beautiful place and get to share this weekend with my wife and meet so many friends that I have here, people I hadn't seen for a while, and new friends. And I'm richly blessed. When I walked out of that treatment center, if you'd have asked me what my greatest fear was, I'd have said, what am I going to tell my friends when they want me to drink? And I believe that God gives you what you need when you need it. And God gave me a poem, and I always close my talks with this poem, because it's what to tell your friends when you're having a bad day. And before I close, I want to thank Sandy again and the committee for having me down here. I don't know if I've said anything to help anybody, but I know that I have done tonight what God set me on this journey to do, and that's to carry a message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope somehow tonight that I have touched your heart, because I know you have touched mine, because I never get up behind one of these podiums that I don't feel that love. And that's God's love that generates through these rooms. And I want to tell you tonight to be kind to one another. If I have a message to carry in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's about love. And it's about being kind to each other and loving each other. Because I'm going to tell you what, folks, we're all we got. Without each other, we're doomed. Welcome that newcomer, and welcome that person in that had to go back out and take a drink. And tell them we're glad they're back, because we need each other. I want to close with this. It's called an AA member's dream. When he said, I dreamed one night I passed away and left this world behind. I started down that lonely trail some of my friends to find. I came to a signboard on the trail, the directions it did tell. Keep right to heaven, turn left to hell. I hadn't been too good on earth, just a hopeless, boozing wreck. I knew there at the crossroads the path I'd have to take. I started down the rocky path that leads to Satan's place. I shook within, not knowing what I'd have to face. Oh, Satan met me at the gate. What's your name, my friend? I'm just sober Sam that came to a bad end. He glanced through the yellow files. You made a mistake, I feared. You're listed as an alcoholic. We don't want you here. I said, I'm looking for my friend. And a smile stole over his face. If your friends are alcoholics, they're any other place. So I went back the way I came to the crossroads I did see. Then I turned right to heaven, as happy as could be. St. Pete smiled and said, come in. I have for you a berth. You are an alcoholic. You had a hell on earth. I saw old Bud, Pete, Bill, and a friend called Bell. And brother, I was tickled because I thought they'd gone to hell. So brothers, I'll take warning. Learn something from my trip. You've got a place in heaven if you try hard not to slip. If someone tips you with a drink when you're not feeling well, just tell them you are going to heaven and they can go to hell. Thank you all.